right? So yeah, today what I want to talk about, it's a bit of a follow-up to Patrick's class this morning, Patrick's lecture this morning. So a lot of the things that you have seen in quantum information theory is pretty kinematic. Like usually we had general states, quite general quantum channels, and it's not so clear why symmetry might play an important role in quantum information theory. So I want to sort of discuss one particular aspect in which it does play a role, sort of actually starting from something that Patrick, I think, discussed this morning, namely Schumacher compression. So let's just briefly recall what the problem there was. So Schumacher compression was the quantum version of data compression. So the idea was you have many copies of a given quantum state, always the same one. Or if you like, you have a source that you can describe by some density matrix. It's an IID source. It's identically distributed independent copies. So you can model it by a tensor approximator like rho tensor n. And so the goal is basically to devise some encoding map that somehow compresses this down to a state rho tilde such from which you can reconstruct these many copies again without making too much of an error. And somehow, I guess what Patrick convinced you was that the performance that you could do this roughly to up like the amount that the rate at which you need to say consume qubits or the qubit storage you need is roughly 2^n times the entropy of the state of the source that you started with. Was entropy S of rho? Okay, S of rho. Plus some epsilon. So this is sort of what's that? Okay. excellent. Okay, so there's two interesting. This is roughly the number of qubits you might need. Suppose rho was the state of a qubit. Naively, you would need n qubits to store such a state, to represent such a state. So that is sort of what you saw this morning. And so now there's two interesting things maybe to observe. So the first is that rho tensor n is a very special state. So in particular, what the state is, the state is has a permutation symmetry, right? Because it's an IID source, you can actually permute. This might be a state of n qubits, but it doesn't matter which one was the first, which one was the second. So that's one natural symmetry, even in this like very general scenario, which is permutation symmetry. Let's write this down. So permutation symmetry. One way to make this more precise is to define an operator for any permutation. So suppose pi is a permutation, then we can define operator r pi. Which takes some string, some basis state of n systems, and it just permutes them, right? So this might be x of, it's customary, I guess, to take the inverse. It doesn't really matter. Pi to the minus 1 of n. So this defines a representation of the permutation group. So pi is a permutation of n elements. This is an operator acting on n copies of some Hilbert space. So this might be the basis state of CD. Tensor n, and so this is a good representation. So now, what it means to be permutation symmetric is that r pi rho tensor n equals rho tensor n r pi. In other words, this permutation action commutes with a density operator.
But d is 2 for qubits, right?
For 2 qubits, if you had n qubits, then d would be 2. And n would be arbitrary. That's right. And we'll actually, for most of the lecture, we'll talk about qubits. So why not just put a 2 here? And then each of these xi's would be either 0 or 1, corresponding to, say, spin up or spin down state, one of these bases. Does that say anything about my notation that is different from this morning's lecture? Excellent. So that's one kind of very general symmetry that really didn't require any physical assumption on our system. It was just the fact that we had the source which did the same thing on every run. Another object that has some symmetries is actually this von Neumann entropy over here, or this entanglement entropy. So the entanglement entropy, of course, only depends on the eigenvalues. So if the eigenvalues are, say, Ri, so you minus sum of all the eigenvalues, I guess in this case, if it's cubus, there's 2 of them, log Ri. Since it only depends on the eigenvalues, actually it's a function that is unitarily invariant. So the entropy of rho is equal to the entropy of u rho u dagger, where u is now an arbitrary matrix. An arbitrary unitary, so maybe I'll So this, in this case, in our case, would be a two-qubit unitary, a two-by-two unitary. In the general case, if these were D-level systems, it would be a D-by-D unitary. Okay. So we also have unitary invariants. And oftentimes in quantum information theory, you know, the problem, again, problem is an IID scenario, so we have commutation symmetry. Oftentimes the optimal rates are actually, you know, given by entropy, various combinational entropies like mutual informations. So again, we have some symmetry. And so what we are going to explore in the coming 50 minutes or so is basically how we can sort of, if we embrace these symmetries, how we can construct protocols, how we can learn something and do some interesting things with quantum information. And so more concretely, I guess, two questions that you might ask us. You saw this protocol for Schumacher compression this morning. It involved, I think, typical subspaces, etc. And this protocol depended on the eigenbasis of the density operator rho. Is that something that... on the other hand, this performance, like this rate, this compression rate, does not depend on the eigenbasis of rho. So is there a way to do, you know, to compress without knowing the eigenbasis? Can we do universal compression? So this would be one one of our motivating questions. Can we do universal compression? So universal means it should be a compression scheme that works for many states at once. For example, all states that have the same eigenvalues, or maybe even all states that have the same entropy, or an entropy that does not exceed some given bound. Another question that you might ask is, you know, since we speak of entropies, the Ryu-Takanagi formula is something that arose quite often. Sometimes there's this question, you know, somehow, why is one side of the Ryu-Takanagi formula given by an operator, this area operator? The left-hand side seems to be an entropy. It's not given. How would we actually measure entropies given a quantum state? So this seems like very hard, but suppose I give you many copies of a quantum state, say n copies of a quantum state. How would you devise an observable that measures the entropy or the eigenvalues with high probability? So we'll see that this can actually be done again by sort of studying the symmetries of the problem. So these are the what we're going to do. Can we measure entropy? Okay, so these are the two things that we're going to discuss. All right. Or maybe even the full entanglement spectrum. Like, why stop with entropy if you can measure the full entanglement spectrum? That might be even nicer. So the setup that we're going to study these questions in, will be qubits, many qubits, just for simplicity. Algebra is from our most simple layer. So we'll choose this local dimension. We'll always choose to be 2. Whenever there might be a D, I should have written 2. In that case, for example, you know, the spectrum of a density operator, so the eigenvalues of some qubit state rho, there's 2 of them, they sum to 1, so I could just as well write them as R1 equals 1/2 plus R, R2 equals 1/2 minus R, R is some number between 0 and 1/2. And if you like, determining the spectrum of a state rho is nothing but determining this number R. In the case of qubits, and likewise, you know, entropy, like entanglement entropy, is a function of R only. So somehow this is the number that we're going to be interested in. All right. So now we want to study this copy. It seems pretty hard to do something that works well for, you know, all states if you have only a single copy of those states. So what about if we have 2 copies? Let's just try to get started by considering 2 copies. Let's try to get started by figuring out this black box. So what if you have 2 copies? So we have rho tensor 2. What would be an interesting observable to consider in that case? How do you guys compute entanglement entropies in field theories? Someone says swap. So What's a swap operator? The swap operator is an operator that acts on two copies of a Hilbert space. It exchanges the two tensor factors. So one way to write it down concretely with respect to some basis would be, you know, ij, ji. I guess we just have qubits, so I and j range from 0 to 1. So why is the swap operator an interesting thing to do? What is actually the expectation value? If you measure the swap operator. You said swap?
It's the purity of
the thing,
right?
Which is a trace of rho squared, right? So this is one way. So the expectation value of the swap, so I guess one way to see it is just actually to insert this formula. Then we have like j rho I times I rho j. So it's just matrix multiplication and forming the trace. Right? This is some, I guess, sum over ij, I rho, j, j rho I. So this is quite nice, right? Because now we learn something new about the spectrum. So if we do this many times, if we measure this swap operator many times, then we'll be able to learn this expectation value pretty well if we do this many times. But this expectation value is now an interesting function, right? It's R1 squared plus R2 squared. I guess in this other parameterization, 1 half plus R squared plus 1 half minus R squared. And so if we have a good estimate of this number, we can reconstruct R, and so we can estimate the spectrum of our qubit. All right? I guess this is nothing, if you like, as, you know, this is sort of the finite dimensional quantum information theory's version of the replica trick. I guess I should have said this before, right? It's kind of like you take two independent copies of a system, but you glue them together in an interesting way, sort of, you know, merging one bra with a cat of the second copy, etc. This is really what the swap operator does. And so likewise, you know, if you didn't only have a qubit, if you had some higher dimensional system, you could take more copies, or you could actually look at all these, right? You could look at a swap operator, you could also take three copies, a cyclic permutation, and so on. So this is really like, you know, how many of you guys like to compute entangled entropies, you know, using the replica trick and then doing some Euclidean path integral. So this is nice. So now we can sort of, from this, we can, you know, we can estimate spectrum. From the spectrum, we can estimate the entropy, etc. I want to sort of interpret this in a different way. Okay, so maybe, you know, just pictorially, if you like. So what you would really do is you would basically build a box. The box measures this, you know, the swap operator. Swap operator has two eigenvalues, plus one on the symmetric subspace, minus one on the antisymmetric subspace. So there's somehow an output plus or minus one, and then you can estimate the expectation value just by doing this many times. On, you know, two copies each. This gives you, know, another like plus minus one answer, and on average, what you will get is something that's close to this one. So that's somehow the protocol, if you like. Now, I guess we already.
Sorry, I missed it. What is plus minus one?
All the eigenvalues of the swap operator. So let's actually zoom into this.
Okay.
So the swap operator, in our case, it acts on two copies of all Hilbert space, right? So this is like two spin 1/2 particles. Now there's, you basically know that this decomposes into a triplet and a singlet. In other words, quantum information theorists like to talk about the symmetric subspace and the anti-symmetric subspace, but really this is just the same thing. So this is the singlet. This is the triplet. By definition, this is the set of all vectors where the swap operator acts by plus one. If you permute the two copies, nothing changes. This is the subspace where the swap operator gives you a minus sign. Let me just play swap operator to the blackboard. The swap operator F acts by plus one here, by minus one here. Right? These are its two eigenvalues. And so when we do measurement, right, we will not get the scalar. We will get either, well, not an arbitrary real number, but we will get either of the two eigenspaces, right? If you think of F as an observable. Okay, so this is what we got. So we get this plus minus one sequence, and in the end we can estimate everything. We might be happy. It turns out that there's a better way. Why should we, why is this not a good idea?
It's, I mean, one way to see this, it's quite destructive. Somehow, if we measure this, somehow, you know, in the end, like, things collapse into either a triplet or the singlet, and then we can't do so much with the state anymore. Another way maybe to see why it's not why it's maybe not the optimal thing to do is, in a way, we are not embracing the full symmetries of the problem. In a way, we are sort of treating, you know, any, like, the first two copies of row at once, the second, the, you know, third and fourth, and so on, up the n minus ones and the n's at once. But we're not actually using that the state is fully permutation symmetric. So this is what I want to do now. So what would be an observable that actually embraces the full symmetry of the problem? If you think about spins, if you think about this interpretation that this was basically spin one half, the triplet is spin one, the singlet is spin zero. What did measuring F really do in that case? Like F is really measuring, you know, up to some reparameterization, was really measuring the total spin. And so measuring the total spin is a nice observable. It commutes with a, like, it's invariant under the unitary group. And it's also invariant under permutation. So let me just write this down and let's discuss about it some more. Let's measure the total spin. So if you like, this is some operator defined as, you know, spin operator on the first and so on up to the nth qubit. It is the operator that on the spin j sector just gives you the scalar j. So let's see what this means. Who of you just remember the Clebsch-Gordan rule for addition of angular momentum? Who of you does not remember the Clebsch-Gordan rule for addition of angular momentum? Who did not raise his hand? non-classical logic going on. So we used, so basically what the Clebsch-Gordan rule tells us is if we, so remember that the irreducible representations of SU2, okay, the spin SU2, the irreducible representations are labeled by this spin, right? And the spin is some half integer. For every positive or non-negative half integer, we get an irreducible representation. So they are labeled by spin j. J is some, you know, non-negative number, half integer. If you have two, so here was an example, right? Spin one half is a particular one. It's just a defining representation, the two-dimensional representation of SU2, where SU2 just acts by 2x2 matrices. But there's other ones, for example, the singlet state, which is just a vector, this vector, 0, 1, I guess minus 1, 0, 1 over square root of 2. This vector is also invariant under unitaries, but it's antisymmetric and it's actually an invariant vector. Okay, so this was what we call spin 0. Spin 1 is this triplet subspace, but we can go on. And the Clebsch-Gordan rule tells us how these things decompose, right? So if you think about, if you say, you know, suppose we took I guess, you know, a spin j irreducible representation, and we tensor it with a spin one half irreducible representation, for example, then the Clebsch-Gordan rule would tell us that we get two contributions. We get the one where we raise the spin by one half, and we get another contribution where we lower the spin by one half unless this is negative. Okay. So what we just did was we just did one half times one half equals one plus zero. This is the rule we just did. Okay. Is there any, like, ask me now if there is any, whoa. Bye, Benny. It's nice seeing you. So syntactically, okay, when I write one half, I really mean just C2. I mean this two-dimensional representation of SU2. And I've decomposed it according to the total spin. And now I can just continue to do this. So suppose we have a state on n copies, on n qubits, C2 tensor n. Then, you know, I could continue decomposing this using the Clebsch-Gordan rule. So I have, you know, a tensor product of many spin one half particles, n of them. I consider the first tensor product. I decompose this into spin one and spin zero. Okay, one plus zero, great. Now we've reduced the problem, right? Because we have like either spin one or spin zero, and then we have n minus two, still n minus two remaining tensor products over here. Now we continue. one tensor one half gives us either three halves or one half. Three half plus one half. But we also have zero tensor one half. And zero tensor one half is just, this is like trivial representation, just doesn't do anything. So we get another copy of one half. Okay. Now we continue this, and so on and so forth. Now there's n minus three of them. In the end, we can decompose this into many, into all kinds of spins. And so the highest spin that will appear will basically, when you always add one half, so if you do this n times, you will get spin n half. And then somehow it decreases by integers. So I'll write j equals 0, but it might also start at 1 half, depending on, you know, if n is even or odd. So maybe I should not write this. Well, maybe I'll write 0. All of them appear. So at the end, a certain spin j will appear with a certain multiplicity. Okay. And for example here, you know, if we had 3 copies, then 3 half appeared with multiplicity 1, but spin 1 half actually appeared twice. So in general, this will be some function. So there will be some multiplicity of spin j if you have n of those guys. So this is, multiplicity. And this is the corresponding representation. So when we measure the total spin, what we are really measuring is kind of in which of these subspaces does our state live. Okay. So this is somehow the total spin. Total spin equals j sector. Now we'll look at this a bit more carefully in a second. It is quite a nice decomposition of. I agree. First thing that we can observe is now this J operator. It's nothing. Okay, it's nothing but it is some observable. Its eigenvalues are labeled by these J's that appear. And, you know, given a certain state, some will appear with a certain probability. And the crucial result that we'll sort of discuss, that was slightly too early. the result that goes back to, and well, it's more general form to Kyle and Werner, sometime in the last decade, I think, is basically the following. Suppose you do this total spin measurement on a tensor product state, okay? Then the probability of outcome j in such a total spin measurement. In other words, it is just the trace of rho tensor n times pj, where pj is the projector on this total spin j sector. So let's say pj is the projector onto this block. This object we can bound, and this object we can roughly bound as follows. I'll suppress some uninteresting constants. It decays exponentially in the distance between j over n and r, where r is the actually this difference of eigenvalues that we considered in red, I guess. So before we said, you know, if we have a qubit, we can parameterize the two eigenvalues by 1 half plus r and 1 half minus r. So this is the r. It is just a function of the spectrum, right? So more this is determined by rho. On the other hand, j is the total spin that we measure, and n is the number of copies that we look at. Okay. So j over n will be something, I guess, between minus 0 and one half, because the maximum positive spin is n half. And the claim is basically that, you know, it is very unlikely to measure a j such that j over n is appreciably far away from r. Okay, like if you sort of plot a histogram of some sorts, say this is, okay, this is not a good idea. Let's plot the histogram. That's not a good idea. Say this is somehow this probability. This is j over n that we measure. Then j over n will be somewhere between 0 and 1 half. Somewhere on this axis there will be a red pen, will be r, the true spectrum. And the claim is that somehow we are pretty, as n increases, this is like the exponential decaying, right? So we sort of have pretty sharp tails, kind of like this. We have sort of exponential tails around the true spectrum. So that's the statement. Okay, so specifically, these are sort of exponential tails.
Michael?
Yes?
Is it not possible to get a Gaussian?
Yes, Gaussian. Yeah, and there's some more refined version of this analysis where you can see Gaussian behavior. But I'm sort of only looking. This is only like a large deviations bound, like a tail bound, if you like. Which, however, will be good enough for what we'll do because I mean it's completely right. Like you can sort of zoom in and you can sort of study like how close is this to a Gaussian behavior. But let's postpone this.
So is it easy to write an explicit basis for P sub J? Like, what is it like?
Yes. So, very good. Maybe we'll do this in 1 second. As I will sort of discuss like what this looks like in a second, then we'll do this. Maybe one hint is sort of you can actually do this Clebsch-Gordan decomposition. You can sort of follow along. So, for example, there's always... So PJ projects onto many copies of the spin J representation, right? Mm. And so it's always easy to find one of them. And one of them, will, namely because, okay, let's do that now just because it's quite an interesting question. So let's actually draw a cartoon of this decomposition that we started doing up there. So suppose N is, you know, this axis looks at the number of copies of C2 that we're looking at, you know, the number of spin 1/2 that we're having. So maybe this is 0, spin 1/2. 1, 3/2, etc. I guess on this axis, I want to plot, you know, the possible values of J. Then, you know, we start out with is this what I want to draw? I guess it is 1/2. This is, sorry. 1, 2, 3, we have an integer number of copies. This is the spin axis, 1/2, 1, 3/2, etc. If you only have one copy, then we just have one spin 1/2, right? And now somehow this rule I wrote down algebraically that if we add another qubit, if we add another spin 1/2, we either go 1/2 up or 1/2 down, we can now draw graphically, right? So this is somehow the first step. Now from two spin 1/2, we can either go here or go down there again. I guess it kind of looks like this. Right? And so now in general, there's many, suppose we have, you know, four copies. Then actually there's many ways of obtaining, you know, a spin, I guess, one representation in here. It basically corresponds to taking a path in this diagram. Let's maybe do the one easier case that we did before. We said that if we have two copies, there's spin 1, spin 0. But if you have three copies, there's actually two spin 1/2 sitting in there. And they correspond to, say, this path and, say, that path over here. Right? Both of these paths end at j equals 1/2. But there's two distinct ones, and so we have two copies. So let me construct one of them for you. So one of them is given by, there's somewhat always an easy path. The easy path is the one that goes like up, down, up, down, up, down, and at some point starts going up. And the reason is that the up, down, I guess a little, I don't know, a little triangle, whatever, like this like just this step, corresponds to singlet state, which we can write down explicitly, right? So basically, we can always produce a singlet given two copies. So let's, you know, we can take 0, 1, minus 1, 0. We can take, say, I guess I want something like n minus 2j of those guys. So this will still be in a spin 0 state, just duplicated. And then we can basically, on the remaining 2j systems, we can find a vector that is contained, a vector that has spin j. And it's basically, I mean, this would be a concrete way of saying it. Another way of saying it would be, it's a vector in the symmetric subspace of 2j copies of C2. So this is a state on n minus 2j qubits. So there's 2j qubits remaining. In the 2j qubits, there's a symmetric subspace of vectors that transform trivially under this permutation group. And it's always irreducible. And it's actually a spin j representation. It's like one way of writing down a spin j representation. So this is very explicit. It gives you one irreducible representation. And it turns out you can get all other ones by permutation, by commuting the parties. And that's maybe...
But another dumb question is, what do you mean by spin zero?
Like, oh.
Yeah, what does spin zero mean?
I mean a vector that transforms trivially when you apply... this is very good. I should have maybe... That this more explicitly. So this vector, maybe let's call this, I don't know, omega, has a property that u tensor u applied to omega equals omega for any unitary matrix u with determinant 1. So this is like, so it's an invariant vector, sometimes called the singlet state. So in particular, it defines a one-dimensional irreducible representation of SU2, like this bit, yeah, right. And so I guess you might remember from your quantum mechanics course that the spin J reduced representative SU2, they have some basis, right? They have a basis labeled by some M. M goes between minus J and J, minus J up to J. So if J is 0, it's like a one-dimensional representation. If J is 1/2, it's a two-dimensional representation, and so on. So we saw, I guess we saw actually all of the representations, because I claimed that I can all think of them as a symmetric subspace. But very concretely, we saw the spin 1/2 one, which is just C2, the triplet, and the singlet. Yeah. So I will not use any, like, I will actually not need to look at what these states look, what these representations look like, but that's what I meant. Some of them are irreducible. So total spin basically just means you act by the same unitary on all sides. That's a good point to make. So likewise, if you like to think infinitesimally, if you have this your spin operator, you know, sigma x squared plus sigma y squared plus sigma z squared, and you look at how it acts, then this is the formula. So you would basically diagonalize this operator. Its eigenvalues are basically this J.
So in kind of like a block sphere picture, R is the length of the vector, right?
Right.
So it's kind of like I just put it n times parallel to itself.
That's right. So somehow, yes.
That's what, okay.
So there's a way of, you could sort of interpret this as some semi-classical limit, if you like, right? You have n copies of the same quantum state, if you think of it on some Bloch sphere. So there's this Bloch sphere picture of, who of you has seen the Bloch sphere picture of a qubit? Ah, very good. So the center corresponds to maximum mixed state. States on the surface of the sphere, they correspond to pure states. So states with spectrum 1 and 0. This one is maximum mixed. And somehow a general state can always be represented by some point on the Bloch sphere. And this is roughly R, or maybe this is R half or something like this. Let's just say R. So this is a graphical way. So the fact that the spectrum is invariant under applying unitaries is the same statement as that the length of this vector is invariant under rotating the Bloch sphere. That is another way to say it. And so in a way, you could say if you have n spins, if you have n copies of the same state, somehow this vector becomes like a classical object that I can actually measure. And so this is really what's going on here. This is some more elaborate machinery where you can really think of this as a semi-classical limit, where some other large n parameter, like is the number of copies of that we get. Right. Maybe just one comment.
Michael, one more question. And
yes.
Somehow, what's the d dependence if you put the d?
If I put the d in,
the convergence will improve. Is it more sharply?
If you look at things that are not qubits,
uh-huh.
You mean like this d?
Yeah.
Very good. Some things become more complicated. Now the spectrum is no longer determined by a single number. It's still possible to find projectors that basically have this property. Now this will be not the distance between two real numbers, but it will be a distance of basically the vector of eigenvalues of rho from something that is called a Young diagram, which probably not so few of you have seen. Does this look like a familiar object to some of you? It is Tetris. It is also so-called Young diagram. So in general, the representation of the unitary group in d dimensions is parameterized by such objects where this is less or equal to d. And basically, for each of these like Tetris shapes, there exists a projector. And the statement is basically the Tetris shape is, I mean, it kind of looks like a spectrum, right? It kind of looks like eigenvalues. It has like four boxes. So, you know, I have three in the first row, one in the second row. If I divide by the total number of boxes, I get something, you know, that looks like eigenvalues. Right? They sum to one, which is not surprising because I divided by the total normalization. But they're also non-negative. And so there's a more general story, basically parameterizing the distance of this normalized Young diagram from the two spectrum. You still have exponential tails. There's a polynomial prefactor, but for large n, it doesn't matter. So that is the story. And this is what those guys really did. All right. Now, somehow, this is a negative result, right? This tells you that the probability of getting J is very small, actually, if J is chosen badly. Does it also tell you that, actually, J will typically be good? Right. So somehow what you want to say is basically the sum of all bad events should be small, not just a single J. So like, why is it so? So I propose that, you know, now to measure the spectrum, what we should really do, spectrum measurement, is basically we should take many copies of the state row. We should measure, you know, J hat. We get some answer, J. And the proposal is basically that J divided by N should be, I claim, as close to the true, you know, eigenvalue difference, or this R, 2 times the eigenvalue difference, the spectral parameter R, with high probability. This is what I claim. So why is this? So well, the reason is basically just the following. So how do I show this? I actually show that, so suppose you have some epsilon. So then we want to be epsilon close. As I claim, you know, for any choice of epsilon, if you look at many, you know, sufficiently many copies, then somehow this will be very close. So J over N will be a good estimate of the spectral parameter. So what I have to argue is basically that all other options together give you a low probability. And so the only thing that we have to observe really is that this is an exponentially low probability. Exponential in n. If you at least say epsilon far away, then you will have sort of, you know, 2 to the minus n times epsilon. But on the other hand, there's actually not many j's. There's only n over 2. So there's only n over 2 roughly. So, you know, roughly n many different values for j. So something exponentially small times something linearly large is still exponentially small. So basically that's the reason why this will work very well if you have many copies. So this is indeed true. And so now we can somewhat less precisely but confidently define an entropy observer. Now we can estimate R, right? So what we would do is basically we could define an operator, say S hat, sum over all J. Then we have these projectors on the spin J sector. And you know, whenever I measure J, then I want to, I would say, well, eigenvalues, you know, are roughly 1/2 plus minus R. So let's just take this as the estimate for the correct eigenvalue and compute the corresponding entanglement entropy. Okay, so this is what I could say. So I could say, well, let's actually write down here the corresponding entanglement entropy. So people like to define what is called the binary entropy function. Let me try again. 1/2 plus J over N, where little h of p is defined as minus p log p minus 1 minus p times log 1 minus p. This is just a Shannon entropy of a binary random variable, right? Because we have qubits, we only have 2 eigenvalues, and it's a binary probability distribution, so it makes sense to do this. So this is entropy, this is a classical entropy of, you know, the distribution p 1 minus p. Now, because I guess J over N will be close to R, then 1/2 plus J over N will be close to the maximal eigenvalue. 1 minus this will be close to the minimal eigenvalue. So we would think that if we observe this observable, then this, so this we call maybe the entropy observable. A entropy observable. And what we claim is that it has the property that, you know, the expectation value. So if you have n copies of your state, you look at what's the expected value of the entropy that you will get. Then you would expect that this is close to, this binary entropy of 1/2 plus r, or the Shannon entropy of 1/2 plus r, 1 minus 1/2 plus r, which is nothing but the von Neumann entropy, right? Because we saw somewhere at the very beginning that the Neumann entropy only depended on these eigenvalues. So now I'm just plugging back in. So this is approximately
I guess, the entropy of rho.
Okay, and to make this precise, I should worry about how continuous is the entropy in this eigenvalue, and I will not, but one should.
So, assuming it would be a problem if r is close to 1/2.
Exactly. Yes. So some of the phenomenon entropy is not differentiable at the corners. I guess you can still give bounds, right? Like some, it grows like a square root or something. So let me. This is something to worry about, but let's maybe not worry about it here. Certainly, if you're deep, sort of within, you know, the spectrum, where it's neither like non-degenerate nor like very close to pure state, then this will work. All right. So now we have sort of constructed this way of measuring this entanglement spectrum of a qubit, given many qubits. Of course, like this will work better and better as the larger and larger n becomes. And again, I have not quantified this on this blackboard.
Do you know how the correction scales with n?
How the correction scale with n? Well, again, it's a bit. I would suspect it's something like. It's a good question. So the problem is basically that.
The thing square root of n.
I think square root of 1 over n.
You normalize, and it's 1 over square root of n.
That is what I would think, because like this. So just to explain the problem. The problem is that this binary entropy function, it kind of looks like this. So it's maximal, you know, for if say this is R1, one of the probabilities. This is H of P. So it vanishes at the extremes. It's not smooth at the extremes. But somehow it behaves like a square root roughly. You can bound it by a square root, so I think that should be okay. There's an inequality, Fun's inequality for comparing. It's basically like in continuity bound on entropies. So again, this is something one should worry about, but I think one over square root of n is, would be my guess. Okay. Oh yeah, I should mention that entropy observers, there's a paper by Brian Swingle, who studies much more general versions. Well, it's about different generalization, I guess. But so this idea of the entropy of linear operators, like what you and Ahmed O'Meary explore much more extensively in your latest preprint. All right.
Michael?
Yes?
So J seems like could be the projector that preserves most of the degree of freedom in the rho tensor N. I think in the morning, Patrick said there for the compression problem, you have some projector that maps to the useful part, which is like the J part, and also the junk part. But there is also actual property of the junk part that is most of them are like decoupled, like classical bits don't have the entanglement with each other. Can I see that problem is here?
Right. So we will.
Or is it different?
Yeah, we'll see this in a bit. Let me maybe come back to this. And if I won't, then I'll talk. That's right. Somehow. Let's say something simple first, and then let's turn to your question. Maybe the simple thing I want to say first. Well, maybe it's not so simple. I guess I only stated the result. I didn't prove it, and I'm not going to. But let me just illustrate how one would actually do this. And so, how does it work? And so somehow, as we do this, we'll pick up some more ingredient that will be useful to answer these questions. So how does it work? So somehow what we have to compute is we have to compute this trace rho tensor n, pj. Now what is rho tensor n? I mean, let's go back. What did it mean to be a spin j representation? It basically meant that if we restrict to the spin j subsector, it meant that u tensor n transforms like a spin j representation when we restrict to the subspace pj, this j subspace. But here we are restricting to this J subspace, and if you sort of allow me to think of rho as a group element and not just as an arbitrary density matrix, then this actually just looks like the trace of U tensor, the trace of the group representation U on the spin J sector. So this is something. Let me maybe write down a formula for this. So let me So what do I mean? So in the sector I have MJN copies of a spin J representation, And on each of these copies, U tensor N transforms, right, like a spin J representation. So if this would be a U, then this would be, well, just some multiplicity, because in all of the copies it behaves the same, and we just have MJ and N copies, times the trace of a spin J representation when we plug in U. Okay, so this this is basically a representation matrix, spin J representation matrix of U. Just by the very fact that, you know, we found this new basis, this new interesting basis for n spin 1/2, sort of stratified according to the total spin. So this is maybe somewhat subtle, right? So this is saying, again, U tensor N on the J subspace actually behaves like spin J, actually like that many spin J's. So the formula sort of follows once you meditate over these sentences, right? Because in each copy it's the same, and this is like how it behaves on a single copy. It's just the trace of the corresponding spin J representation matrix. Okay. So this is true if U is a unitary matrix. It's also true if it's a general invertible matrix, and you can sort of take limits for arbitrary matrices. And so in fact, this would be true if we replace this by rho tensor N. Well, and this by rho. And so this is basically the way this bound proceeds. It basically proceeds by estimating this piece and that piece. And if you do so, you basically get, you can upper bound this by 2 to the minus n times the relative entropy distance. The relative entropy was maybe a distance measure that some of you have computed on field theory. Others have probably seen sometime past week. Just one sec. And so then if you can bound the relative entropy further, then you just get this difference of eigenvalues that are that I wrote down over here. So somehow the way you get this bound is by upper bounding both of these pieces. Yes, Rigan?
U was an SU2 matrix, right? So I know what RJ of U is, but if rho is not in SU2, then what is RJ of rho?
If it's an SL2, you can just do the same formula. It's complex, like it's holomorphic, if you like, so you can just continue. It's called Weyl's unitary trick, like somehow the representation theory is the same of the group SU2 and SL2. Now, you might argue that actually rho is not even an SL2, even if it's invertible, because the determinant is not 1, the determinant is the product of the eigenvalues. So actually, to make this work, it's like, well, I could think of it both ways. I could actually think of this. One easy way to make it work is actually divide by the square root of the determinant, so that the resulting matrix is determinant 1. So I should actually pull this out and so on. But the story is really you want to work with SL2 and actually also GL2. But you know that U tensor N, if you multiply your matrix by some lambda, then this will just come out as a factor lambda to the N, right? So somehow you know what happens when you rescale by scalar. So you can just rescale your density matrix into a non-density matrix, but something that has determinant 1. So these are the kind of technical tricks that are involved.
Also, is MJN a representation of SN, the dimension of a representation?
This is also correct. The formula we wrote down here, that C2 tensor N, decomposes according to the total spin. I sort of casually wrote, you know, this number of copies of J. There's sort of a more mathy way of writing it. You could say, well, you take a spin J representation and tensor it with some multiplicity space. And this multiplicity space has dimension MJN. As long as I don't tell you what's going on there, that's just the same thing as before, right? It's just saying, if you have some U tensor N, if the unitary group acts as U tensor N on the left-hand side, then there's some basis transformation such that in the new basis, this acts block diagonally in J, and here it acts as RJ of U, tensor the identity on this multiplicity space, right? Identity on, maybe I'll write MJN. This is sort of the maybe a more mathematical way of writing down what we did here. Now it turns out that there's not only the unitary group, but the symmetric group that we mentioned before. So the symmetric group also acts on n copies of your spin 1/2, and it exchanges the factors. Now there's something called Schur's lemma, which basically implies that whenever you have two commuting group actions, then the multiplicity spaces of one group action become representations of the other group action. So let me just claim this and not go too much into this. So this is actually a representation of the symmetric group Sn, so that is of permutations. And it turns out, as I think you were suggesting, that it's actually an irreducible representation. So this is so we have this beautiful picture where this is an irreducible, this is like an SU2 representation, an irreducible one. This is an irreducible representation of the permutation group. Obviously, the two group actions commute on the right, they commute on the left, and we have this isomorphism. Okay, and this is called Schur-Weyl duality. And so really, this is somehow the working horse that generalizes even, you know, even to higher dimensional systems and where these Young diagrams appear, etc. Very good. For our purposes, we are not maybe at this point, at no point, think of this as a representation of this metric group. But we'll just think of this as a multiplicity space. And the one thing I want to discuss is basically how large is this multiplicity space. Okay. Because the answer is quite beautiful and maybe explains why relative entropies would appear. So the claim is that the answer is as follows. Well, what was this number actually? So just to remind you, this was the number of paths in this diagram up there, paths starting at 0 and ending at j after n steps. That's what we had to, that's what we had to count, right? Because the number of times this spin j representation appeared in C2 tends to n, it was just precisely this number, right? Like here was this twofold degenerate way of arriving at spin 1/2 and 3 copies. And more generally, you have to look at arbitrarily path and what is called a Bertelli diagram. Now it's sort of clear from this formula that you could write down a recursion formula for this multiplicity, for this number of paths. And so you can solve this recursion, and the answer you get will be something involving binomial coefficients. And so then you can, you know, use Stirling's approximation to bound this binomial coefficient. And what turns out is actually that this number is less or equal to 2 to the n times, well, this binary entropy of 1/2 plus j over n. Okay. So again, this is some, this is n, makes things scale. So what does this mean? Okay. So before we saw that, 1/2 plus jn is just some number between 1/2 and 1. So we can think of this as the larger of two probabilities. We can compute this binary entropy that was on the board here. And the claim is that this multiplicity space, so the number of copies here, it actually grows, you know, like 2 to the n, it grows at the rate given by this binary entropy. On the other hand, it turns out that, well, a spin j representation has 2j plus 1 basis vectors. So it's actually very small. It's only polynomially large. So really, most of the Hilbert space sits in these multiplicity spaces. So this red part is like super big, and this is very small. So why is this interesting? So what do we do? So what did we achieve? So we did this measurement. We said, well, we have to do a measurement outcome with high probability. We end up somewhere, you know, where j over n is roughly r. On the other hand, what does this sort of remind you of? Okay. Yeah, so this is indeed one way of doing compression. And coming back to this first question, right? So on the second question we already solved. The first question was like how to do universal compression, how to do compression if we don't know, say, the eigenbasis. So so how do we do it? Well, again, before we had this exponential bound, so let's rewrite this in a sort of an optimistic way. So one thing, let me just see how I wanted to write this down, actually. So let's use what we just said to do compression. We'll call this universal compression. And so the idea is basically just the following. Define P. So a single projector PJ might have very small probability, right? The only statement that we got before is that we will, with high probability, get some J such that J over N is close to R, to the true spectrum. So let's just write down the sum of all these orthogonal projectors that satisfy this property. Let's say, you know, J over N minus R, you know, should be like less or equal to some epsilon. So why don't we do this? So now suppose we do a measurement, we do a test, we take n copies of the state, and we apply, you know, we apply this projection. We measure this projector if we want. Well, now what we'll get is that actually this, you know, so before we said that any of the other projectors, for any of the other projectors, this is at least epsilon away. So we have this exponentially small probability, you know, somehow 2 to the minus n epsilon, and I guess I was actually missing a square in what I wrote over there. Maybe I'll not fix it. Should I fix it? I think this is actually a square. Sorry about that. So this is somehow the probability for one of these bad j's. Now there's at most linearly many bad j's, but we're interested in the good j's, okay? So we take one minus. So the probability that this projector says, yes, we are in the subspace, is actually pretty large. It goes to 1 because this decays, and this is only linearly large. So this goes to 1. So this projector basically almost always succeeds. But what is the space that the projector projects on? Okay. So again, the point is like we have our exponentially big Hilbert space, a test size dimension 2 to the n. P is some projector which project on the subspace. We want to know how large is the subspace. Onto subspace. Well, let's bound the rank. Okay, each of these guys. What's the rank of the projector? What's the dimensional subspace that we should project on? Well, how many summons are there? Okay, we just be super coarse. We just say, let's say there's n such summons. But on each summoned, somehow, you know, j over n is roughly r. So 1 half plus j over n is roughly 1 half plus r. So this binary entropy is actually very close to the von Neumann entropy of our original quantum state. So it turns out that we can, you know, we can say this is roughly 2 to the n times s of rho, maybe plus some epsilon prime, some delta. Let's just leave ourselves a bit of space because everything, you know, we always had to apply some continuity that I never talked about. So let's just give ourselves a little bit of space. But really, this n factor, of course, like is very small, right? We can actually absorb this into delta. So what this is really saying that we are consuming qubits, that this space is roughly 2 to the n times s of rho large, you know, plus some small constant that we can make small, as small as we like. So somehow, what we found is that this projection into subspace of size roughly n times s of rho qubits. Okay. So again, you know, we take our quantum states, rho, many copies of rho. We measure basically p as thinking of it as an observable. So we get either 1 or we get 0 as the answer. Okay. We get 1 if somehow, we get either 1 or 0. We know that we get the 1 case with very high probability because that's the probability that this device outputs 1. Okay, so somehow 1 with high probability. And in that case, if you look at the post-measurement state will be p rho tensor np. And this is a state supported on a very small subspace. And so, you know, we can do some like crazy unitary transformation that sort of actually moves the subspace into some, you know, roughly n times the entropy many distinguished qubits. And this is where our information will be stored. Okay, so there will be some base transformation, basis transform, if you like, in such a way, right? We have like many qubits incoming. We still have n qubits here. I guess we actually have n qubits here. These are n lines, n single qubit lines. Now we do base transform. This number of qubits sits here. Then there will be some other like junk qubits, but those are we just ignore. And these are the ones that we keep. And by doing so, we don't have to disturb the state very much. And so this is basically a universal way of doing compression. Okay. So are there any like direct questions or should I just start? Yeah.
So MJN you said is less than or equal to this quantity, right?
Right.
So I'm presuming you're using it's roughly equal to it in some asymptotic.
Oh yeah, I'm just bounding the rank of this projector. I could always be, you know, maybe I get lucky and it's actually smaller, but even in the worst case, it's only as large as the von Neumann entropy. And you can actually bound it in both ways.
But, to be fair, that's what I'm like. Typically, we expect that we can't do better than S of rho, right?
And that is right.
So you would need the other.
Though, of course, this statement you cannot see from what I did because I only gave you a protocol for achieving this rate. You know, maybe there's some other, and you know, maybe I didn't use all the symmetries of my problem and I actually told you about a not so interesting protocol. So you need an information theoretic proof that somehow tells you that you cannot do better in any protocol. I'm not sure if this is something you have seen, but right. Very good. So okay, so what did we achieve? So we achieved basically a compression scheme that does not only work for, you know, states when you know the eigenbase, but for all states that have a certain spectrum. Now let's actually do something funny. How would you do a compression scheme that works for all states? So somehow that still doesn't sound like super universal, right? Because somehow, well, we have to know the eigenvalue. Now we saw how to measure the eigenvalue, so we could do this, right? We could measure the eigenvalue, then we know what to expect. Then we do the right protocol. There's also a way, like sort of a nice variant of this, where you can devise a compression protocol that basically works for all states whose entropy does not exceed a certain bound, say R. And the way is basically, you know, instead of summing over all the J, such that J of N minus R is less or equal to epsilon, you just sum over all J's, alternative, sum of all J's such that this binary entropy, you know, of J over N plus 1/2, you know, is roughly, and again, I'm being imprecise, the phenomenon, some bound, let's call this, I don't know, delta or something. So this would be a compression protocol. If you do the same estimate here, instead of getting the phenomenon entropy of your state, you will get this artificially chosen constant delta. But now this protocol will work for all states for which the entropy is no larger than delta, kind of by definition, right? Because I just took those J's, but we are very likely to be supported in that case. So that would be an even more universal protocol. But of course, since I don't know which state you actually gave me, this protocol will always use 2 to the n times delta much storage. Like it will never do worse. Like it's because it sort of has to accommodate for the worst case if you give me actually a state that has this entropy. All right. So maybe I'll sorry for running slightly over time. Maybe I'll conclude here. We can come back to Java's question. After this, thanks very much for coming. Okay. Any questions?
Sure. So this is really a naive observation, but the decomposition of the Hilbert space you wrote there is very similar to something we saw last week with Benny Yoshida on subsystem codes. Is that related? Since the rate you get for a channel is like your optimal encoding, and it would be a subsystem code.
Was this in the context of having some algebra or something?
Yeah.
Right. Like if you, that's right. So this is a decomposition for groups, but you could do the same for an algebra of observables, say. These are kind of like super selection sectors.
Okay.
Corresponding to the fact that this group acts like in a block diagonal way, like it can never, you know, like you can never send a spin J into spin J prime acting with the group because the spin is preserved, the total spin is preserved.
Yeah.
And there's also this multiplicity space. So maybe this is, I'm not sure 100% like what he did, but it should be related.
Okay.
Maybe the same thing, but similarly is if you have some phenomenal algebra, so some subset of observables, you can always decompose in that way.